This is Monocle on Design, Monocle's weekly show on the best in architecture, industrial design, graphics, and fashion. I'm Daphne Karnizis. Coming up today, a smorgasbord of interviews from hospitality, furniture design, and fashion.
We are actually able to create an experience that is far more human and far more personal because we are freeing people from these sort of trivial day-to-day tasks that don't add a lot of value to our customers. And we are enabling them to spend their time taking care of our guests.
We visit the Toronto Hotel that's tastefully redefining hospitality's relationship with technology. And
they're kind of curious, and I want to understand where the product came from, how it was treated in the supply chain, and where it's going to after they dispose of it.
We'll bring you our interview with the CEO of Australian wool company Woolmark from the leading menswear trade show Pitti Uomo in Florence. Plus, a word with Canadian-born London furniture designer Philippe Malouin at Design Basel. All that coming up right here on Monocle on Design. Now, we can all agree that technology presents opportunity, but for hotel designers around the world, re-envisioning the hospitality experience through the lens of automation is rarely done well. And when technology is used to replace human interactions, more often than not, it can lead to impersonal experiences and bouts of frustration all around. You might recall the hotel in Japan that had to lay off half of its 243-strong team of robots because they were creating more problems than they could solve. But not so at Toronto's Annex Hotel. Alexander Lin, the hotel's creative director, met with Monocle's Will Kitchens to discuss how technology, when executed thoughtfully, can lead to a more human hospitality experience.
Tucked inside one of the 2,400 alleyways weaving throughout Toronto is the Annex Hotel, open since October 2018. The 24-room boutique hotel, found inside the city's Annex neighborhood, is stylish. Its guest rooms have whitewashed walls, record players, and blonde wood beds. The hotel's coffee/cocktail bar is dotted with leather sofas, marble top tables, and emerald green walls. But the Annex isn't just another trendy hotel built in the mold of the Ace or the Standard. It's also, arguably, Toronto's most ambitious and unique hotel. There's no front desk, no bellhops or even doormen. Even room keys have been eradicated from the premises. Instead, the Annex has redesigned the hospitality experience in a decidedly tech-forward fashion. On a bright Tuesday afternoon, I departed from Monocle's Toronto bureau and headed to the Annex to see what the fuss was all about. But first, I had to find it.
A lot of hotels are very easy to find, but they're not particularly novel. Here at the Annex, it's a little harder. We're off the beaten path. We're down an alleyway. It's confusing, but when you walk in, you feel like you just stepped into another world. And we think that that is a really, really special moment that people come to cherish.
That's Alexander Lin, the Annex's creative director. He's designed the entirety of the hotel's brand since its inception, from picking soaps and sheets to designing its brand identity. He took me on a tour of the hotel, beginning with one of its 24 guest rooms.
So the day of your check-in, you get an email. It has a PIN code in it. You let yourself into your own room as of 3 p.m. So you just walk upstairs. There is a lock on the door that accommodates that PIN code, and you just kind of punch it in. And it opens up. So I think the big thing that makes us unique here is that we've had a core focus on technology from day one.
At first glance, the Annex might seem like the anti-hotel. Gone are in-room phones, TVs, and room keys. But while you might assume that the lack of a doorman or a front desk would lead to an impersonal experience devoid of human interaction, according to Lin, that's not the case. Here, technology is simply a means to an end.
Every single one of our rooms, you let yourself into on your own by just putting in a PIN code that is emailed to you the day of your check-in. What that enables us to do is minimize the amount of staff that we have on site, and more importantly, not have a front desk. And as a result of those decisions, we are actually able to create an experience that is far more human and far more personal, because we are freeing people from these sort of trivial day-to-day tasks that don't add a lot of value to our customers. And we are enabling them to spend their time taking care of our guests in ways that are a lot more value additive. Examples of that would be, to your point, we don't have keys here. We don't have somebody at the front desk that is waiting for you to, you know, check you in because you've checked yourself in ahead of time. We don't have somebody that is going to take your credit card and swipe it through the computer. All of these things are very transactional, and we try to ensure that all of those are automated so that the people that work here can genuinely spend their time being great hosts as opposed to just, you know, taking care of those transactional needs that come with your stay. With that said, we haven't, you know, cut away any of the staff, meaning if you still are asking for the best restaurant in town or wondering about where to go for a great show, those people are there and actually 100% available to answer those kind of questions, as opposed to being behind the front desk occupied with things that do not add as much value to the customer experience.
Is that a fine line to walk? Can the technology side of things really be overdone?
I think that most hotels today have realized the importance and impact of technology and are trying to build it in some way, shape, or form to their guest experience. I think the problem, though, is that most of them are replacing humans by technology, and what we've tried to do here is rather to add technology so that the people that work at the Annex can be more efficient in their day-to-day.
How do you go about evaluating what exactly is unneeded or unnecessary in a hotel, and what elements or core pieces really need to be maintained?
What's needed or unnecessary actually varies for everyone. And we just believed that there was a hole in the market, one where there was an entire generation or category of consumers that weren't being served by sort of the best hotels of today. And when we set out, we created what we believe to be the five-star hotel for people that were never served by five-star hotels. A lot of people today don't need anyone to hold the front door, but care a lot about the quality of the coffee that they get in the morning, or the, you know, quality of the food that they'll eat that night, or the connections that they'll make while staying there. And these were the things that we believed needed far more attention. No rooms have a television here at the Annex. Every single room is equipped with a 13-inch iPad Pro, mostly because it aligns with how people like to consume content today. And there are a range of hotels that have a television, or many of them, throughout the hotel walls. We just weren't that kind of place. And we knew that our customers weren't those kind of people either. They came here to discover the city rather than stay in and, you know, consume the evening news. That was a saving that we, you know, strategically chose to make in order to invest in another part of the guest experience. And that's kind of how we approach design overall. Every single dollar that could be saved in one place was actually just a dollar that could be spent somewhere else. And by spending our dollars in the right place, we genuinely believed that we were capable of creating something that would serve the customers of today a lot better than a lot of the hotels that were out there. Some of that came to life by ensuring that we had a record player in each room that collaborated with a local record store so that we could have, you know, great music in every room. We also collaborated with a local bookstore that has a selection of books in every single room. We spoke about local art. We spoke about, you know, local amenities like the soap, the sheets, the custom blankets that we developed, the local coffee program in partnership with, you know, one of the best coffee houses and roasters in the country. All of these things we believe really, really matter to the people and customers that stay at the Annex, more so than a lot of the, you know, typical things that you'd find in a hotel, like televisions or like a doorman or like a large parking or so on and so forth.
While we've discussed the design of processes and services, let's jump to the physical space. When you have a tech-forward hotel, do material choices and tactility, do they become an especially important part of the architecture and interior design?
Technology, as I've said earlier, is I think something here that we wanted to sort of improve the experience, but it certainly doesn't replace the care and the details. If anything, I think it makes it even more important. You'll notice that the rooms use a lot of custom millwork, very little furniture. That ensures that actually the rooms have an incredible layout in terms of space, and I think you can feel it when you walk in here. They're designed in a way that actually improves the overall flow and guest experience. The other part of that for us that's actually beneficial is durability on the long term. There's very little furniture because all of it is actually built into the walls, even the beds, and a result of that is that it minimizes the sort of amount of damage, the amount of things that the cleaning staff need to move on the day-to-day because people have moved it around the rooms, and increases the efficiency of the property overall. And as a property that cares a lot about increasing efficiency in order to kind of minimize the amount of time that our staff needs to spend, you know, on these details, this was a design consideration. In many ways, the technology sort of disappears and fades into the background.
That was Alexander Lin, creative director at the Annex Hotel in Toronto, speaking to Monocle's Will Kitchens. The annual international design fair Design Miami Basel wrapped up last week in the Swiss city. Monocle's design editor Nolan Giles was there, and one of the people he spoke to is Canadian-born London furniture designer Philippe Malouane, who has a unique take on office furniture, using industrial materials such as nylon, rubber, and steel in unique ways. Here's the interview.
We created a lot of research, to be honest. Everything that you see here is very much research-based office furniture, riffing off executive archetypes from the 50s to the 70s and reinterpreting all those things by using different materials for functional reasons. Nylon being a good example. Nylon is a self-lubricating plastic. We decided to create executive desks and chest of drawers using only the functional material that you would have in a traditional piece of furniture, but using that as the main constructing body. So all the elements slide on themselves. There's no hidden mechanics. It's very much about immediacy, modularity, and functionalism.
And there's definitely an approachability to the pieces. You know, we're looking at the desk, and there's a phone on there. Somebody's used this space over here to put something on it. It doesn't feel like, you know, we're looking at precious pieces of design. But from what I understand, they were quite labor-intensive to create. Can you tell us a little bit about the process and how you see these pieces as valuable objects?
If you want to start with the nylon is a functional plastic. It's quite an expensive material. It wouldn't be necessarily regarded as a fancy material, especially as opposed to when you walk around the fair and then you see all these exotic woods and all these patinaed and polished metals. It's very much the antithesis to that. But what's interesting is that these other materials are used for only for their aesthetic, well, not only, but very much because of their aesthetic purposes. Whereas we wanted to interpret the idea of luxury from a hyper-functional standpoint. So that's why we use these functional materials that could be considered inappropriate, but bring them back into different archetypes and contexts that you wouldn't necessarily expect them to. And the sheer use of them and the mass of these materials actually make them very special collectible items.
You know, you're front and center here at Design Miami in Basel. As you walk in, you know, you've created something very eye-catching. Can you tell us about what you thought about, in collaboration with the gallery, to create something that fitted in here but also stood out?
We've been working on certain office-based projects for the last 2 years at the studio, and when Paul Johnson came to the studio, as he does ever so often to do studio visits, and he sees the type of research that we're doing, we've been working on very traditional pieces of, you know, furniture and office accessories, etc. And he hinted that it could be a good idea to put a part of our research into a gallery show, and that was over eight months ago.
I'm particularly interested in the rug. I'm guessing you call it a rug, but it kind of has like a chainmail feel to it. Can you take us through this product and how it kind of contrasts with the, I guess, more colorful elements as well?
For the show, we used really only three different materials. We used nylon, steel, and rubber, and they're all obviously clearly industrial materials. Steel being industrial material 101 for many reasons, because it can be formed in precisely the way you want to. It can be milled, it can be bent. And the rug is a good example of that, because it's reinterpreting an archetype by using another material. So we decided to make a chainmail rug out of steel. And this will weather, will age, and it will live on just like a regular rug would, but with more of a indestructibility aspect to it.
And how important is that to you, creating pieces that are valuable to be sold at, I guess, a collectible design fair? Indestructibility, you know, it's quite a powerful word to talk about furniture, because often you see pieces and they do look delicate and you don't know if you want to sit on them or if you want to stand on them or if you want to touch them. You've used that word, which is kind of the opposite. You can do anything to it and it will still have its value. So how important is creating something that's tough?
I think it's important as much as it is for a gallery-based design or a standard industrial design. We're discussing the solid wood table for SCP that we made. That's really important to us, that things are meant to last, and also things are meant to weather and age and change and not necessarily be considered without value once they age. And a lot of these materials and a lot of these pieces that you see are... they have a very strong presence, both from a mass aspect, but from a durability aspect. So, you know, they're definitely not flimsy. They're very much the opposite of flimsy, and they're here. They have not a temporary presence. They have a very strong, timeless presence. So they will last. And I think if you're going to create something, you might as well want it to last and last a really long time, because A, you don't want it to end up in landfill, but B, if you're spending the money, it should last you a lifetime.
You mentioned that you were doing a lot of research around the office, and I guess today's office is in a weird space where people want the office to feel like home, but also it needs to be a place of work, and maybe people aren't so sure about open plan and how it can make people as productive as it's supposed to be.
Yeah.
What did you learn about the office in your research, and how do you think of a, you know, perfectly designed office?
The perfectly designed office doesn't exist, because it's always a fine balance between aesthetics and how people inhabit the space. So we just decided to set ourselves out on certain key themes instead of trying to create the perfect office, which is not what this is about. But movement is a big idea of the office and how we operate in an office. So if you look around us, we're in chairs that swivel in order to follow or sit somewhere else in a conversation. But the idea of movement here has been interpreted in order to use the materials to make you move. The same goes for the desks and the drawers that are behind us. It's all about how you use all the functional materials and how you use all the furniture, the movements. I wanted to reinterpret them in a really physical way without, how can I put this, without using things that could break, without using drawer runners or mechanical elements or anything. Everything is extremely simple, and you understand the movement just by looking at the pieces. And that's one of the key themes that we had when we were looking at the office. Another one was durability, obviously, and engineering. Obviously, all of the nylon pieces are extremely engineered. And another key theme that we had that you can see with the metal pieces, which is a contrast that we wanted to do with the show, was the ad hoc idea of creating elements like this. So the office chair that we created was done in one day in a metal workshop, just by cutting steel tube together and applying some of the notions that we've gained, notions of adjustability and notions of ergonomics, but interpreting those notions in a really ad hoc and quick way. So that, you know, so both our engineering and ad hocness are kind of diametrically opposed, but in the show they kind of exist together, and it forms a tension that's interesting.
And just finally, you mentioned you're in London now. We've talked about the pieces and the design. It'd be great to hear a little bit about the manufacturing, where it was done, the difficulties or maybe the luxuries of being a designer based in London.
Well, to be honest, none of those pieces were manufactured in London. Very few things are manufactured in London these days. The nylon pieces were done in the north, and the steel pieces were done at a friend's workshop in the south near Brighton. And actually, the rubber chairs were cast in our Hackney Central studio by ourselves, because we couldn't find anyone else to do them for us. The steel rug was done in Lithuania, and the coffee table was done done in the north of England as well. So there's still a fair bit of manufacturing in the UK. You just got to know where to look. And to be honest, a lot of the proximity of those manufacturing places is influencing the work that we do. So we found this brilliant nylon company and we're able to work with them. And to be honest, no one's worked with it in the design world, which is crazy. And we've developed this relationship and we started working together. And I think it's worked because it's created a body of work that didn't exist before and it feels new. And we used the resources that we have in the UK. So most of the things were done in the UK.
So you're a happy Londoner at the moment?
Yeah, definitely I'm a happy Londoner. You know, if you look at other cities like New York City, London's wildly affordable in comparison, and it's still possible to lead a nice life. Just got to know where to go. Probably one of the reasons why we're so interested in offices is because we'd love to have a slightly better office of our own one day, because our office is quite dingy. It's small. It's a small studio. It's not easy. It's expensive. So yeah, maybe that's something that's been on our minds.
That was furniture designer Philippe Malouin speaking to Monocle's design editor Nolan Giles in Basel. Get your copy of our Basel special newspaper with plenty of reports from the fair and more available on select newsstands at monocle.com and one of our Monocle shops. And finally on the show today, earlier this month the Fashion Pack descended on sunny Florence in Pitti-Uomo, the world's leading menswear trade show. One of the projects that caught our fashion editor's eye was a standout collaboration between trailblazing Australian wool firm The Woolmark Company and Prada. The two brands have joined forces on a new uniform for Italy's 2021 America's Cup sailing team. Monocle's Jamie Waters sat down with Stuart McCullough, managing director of The Woolmark Company, to find out more about the handsome steel grey kit. McCullough started by talking about the partnership with Prada.
Prada, from a tailored textile point of view, have been a partner of ours before. We've known them for a long time. We have a relationship with them. They're very, very good people to work with. So we did have some history with this company. They came to us exploring the opportunity of a sponsorship for Luna Rossa, which is the Italian boat for the America's Cup in 2021. We thought it was a good opportunity for us to do just that, you know, get out of our space of tailored textiles and profile wool as a technical textile. We have wool being used in run and in yoga and in outdoor and a whole lot of other sports fields. But we hadn't done anything in the past in the areas of aquatic, and surf and yachting were areas that were a bit of a white space for us. And we saw this as a good opportunity to profile our fibre in that category. And so that's how it came about.
I think a lot of people don't associate wool with being a technical sort of performance wear product, and then even more so with being for aquatic sports, as you say. What kind of properties about wool lend itself to sailing, surfing, those kind of sports? Like what works?
Oh, well, look, warmth is one thing. They're often cold out there, and you know, to have base layer knitwear that's warm, that can wick moisture off the body and get it to the outside of the garment, and so that's one element of it. There's a number of really technical textiles in that range of garments that the crew are using, and you know, warmth was one of those things. You know, they tested this well. We've been in testing with them now for 6 months or so. You know, I was with the crew for dinner last night, and they were telling me how amazed they were. You know, they're typically in man-made petroleum-based products that don't breathe so well, and you know, they were just super surprised at how it did perform in a whole lot of different areas. Of course, they're on the boat, they're sometimes very active, sometimes they're not. When they're off the boat, they need to be warm. So it's working for them in a whole raft of different ways. You know, they're delighted how it's performing. And we kind of knew that would be the case, but you got to let them try it out and see how they go, and they're delighted.
Can you tell us a bit more about this testing process? It's obviously kind of very rigorous. When it comes to testing, how much is that Woolmark? How much is it Prada doing it? Or is it all sort of joined? Like, how does it kind of work?
The best way to test a garment is put it on someone and under the conditions that they're going to be either sailing in or active in. And that's what we did. You know, we had that team kitted out with these garments, and they put them through their paces, and they put them through their paces when they're active and not active and on the boat and off the boat. So, you know, that's how we tested it. I mean, the fabrics that they're using actually well tested technically they've been tested. They've been tested by the manufacturers. So, you know, they will stand up to what the manufacturer promises. What happens when you cut a garment, tailor a garment, it's got to be tailored in the right way to suit that particular activity that they're doing. So, you know, some of this just came down to simply modifying the cut of the garment. That's how we tested them. They were tested in a lab, of course, prior. The real test comes is whether they can wear them and whether they're performing on the boat.
You've done a lot of collaborations with different sportswear brands, and I'm interested in this kind of what your thoughts are on the fashion industry becoming increasingly interested in technical products. And where do you think this kind of comes from, this idea of whether you're, you know, of course, regular sports brands, but just more lifestyle, more fashion brands become interested in high performance products? What's your kind of take on this interest from the industry?
Well, we saw this starting to happen a number of years ago. The Americans would call it athleisure, you know, which is kind of an amalgam of, you know, fashion and active sports. I think it's the way we live. I think we've changed the way we live these days. And the way we live today is, you know, often we'll go out and exercise in the morning and, you know, you mightn't get out of what you're wearing, you know, and you want something that looks half decent for the rest of the day. We've seen this emerging for a long time. We also think that Gen Ys and Gen Zs, for our fibre anyway, are particularly interested in seeing some more natural fibres in those garments. You know, typically run, sports, active, yoga, outdoor have been man-made petroleum-based products. And I think those Gen Ys really want to, they're kind of curious and they want to understand where the product came from, how it was treated in the supply chain, and where it's going to after they dispose of it. They are very conscious of microplastics and those sorts of things. I think the Gen Zs, if you're born after 2000, you're a Gen Z and you're about to get some decent spending power. I think they're going to be more curious about this, and that's going to work for us. You know, that's going to work for us. We just got to make sure that we're in all the spaces they want to be in. We don't want to just be in tailored textiles. We want to be in technical textiles, broken down by every category, including, you know, sailing. That's really the aim. So when we can see an opportunity like something that we haven't had some energy put into in the past, we try and go after it, and that's what happened here.
You said that you know, you're obviously very interested in pushing more into this kind of technical market. Is a big part of that because it's been so dominated historically by synthetic textiles, and you think that natural fibres are obviously like a really valid solution?
Yeah, look, it works for us on a number of fronts. That's certainly an opportunity for us. The run companies, the big sports companies, all know that they're going to have to get some more natural fibres into their collections. So it certainly works there. You know, a market for us that's a bit of a void is the United States. We know that they certainly underconsume on a per capita basis wool. Just to compare someone from Europe versus someone from the States, someone from Europe will typically consume about a kilogram of wool a year. You know, they'll buy and consume a kilogram of wool a year. In the States, it's about 300 grams. So it's a sort of a bit of a worry for us that they're underutilising a fibre. With the same population, same affluence, same climate, pretty much, they underconsume. We think that this particular space, this athleisure space, as they'd say it, is an opportunity for us there. We think that they dress down a bit more. The casualisation of their wardrobes is well advanced. And we think that this sports active area is going to offer us an opportunity. Even if we, you know, if you think of the population in North America, even if we lifted it from 300 to 400 grams, you know, it's a big jump. And it's a big demand driver for our product. And that's really what we're after, is to lift demand slightly above supply and see the prices go up.
Your collaboration with Prada, will a version of that be available for sale to the public, presumably?
Yeah, absolutely. It won't have, you know, the garments that they're wearing are super high tech, so they've got some bells and whistles on them. But yeah, absolutely. The merchandising of this range is well advanced, and you know, we that was certainly part of the deal is to merchandise product with wool in it and demonstrate so that it's not just me talking on a radio interview about how good it is. So you know, people can actually go out and use it and see for themselves how good it is.
Stuart McCullough there, Managing Director of the Woolmark Company, speaking to Monocle's fashion editor, Jamie Waters. Sadly, that's all we have time for today. And don't forget, if you need a little more design-minded inspiration, you can subscribe to this show and our sister podcast, On Design Extra, available each Thursday. You could also pick up a copy of the latest issue of Monocle magazine, available on newsstands. Monocle on Design was produced by myself, Daphne Karnitzis, and edited by Kieran Banerjee. Bye for now!